Of course, this is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's a really familiar story to all of us, even our children. And it's so familiar that I'm afraid that the power and the force of this story is often lost on us. You know the difference between watching a suspenseful movie for the very first time? You don't know how it's going to end. No one has given you any spoilers or anything. You have no clue. The difference between watching for the first time and watching that same movie for the 100th time is, of course, you know how it's going to turn out. You know everything's fine. And so when your hero gets mortally wounded or he's tragically defeated, you know, because you've seen it 100 times, you comfort yourself, right? You know that everything's going to turn out. Well, when you're watching it for the first time, you don't know that. I think we read this story as if we're watching it for the 100th time. We know it so well. We know that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to be rescued from the fiery furnace. But the thing about this is, that's not what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew. They did not know at all how this was going to turn out. The passage that Christian read for us a few moments ago, what they say is, God is able to deliver us, but if he does not, we're not going to bow down. They didn't know for sure how this was going to end out. So what I'd like us to do tonight is challenge ourselves to read this story as if we're watching this movie for the first time. And in order to help us do that, I want to do something a little different tonight. I'm going to tell you the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from their perspective, as if I'm relating it to you firsthand, okay? So here we go. My name is Azariah. Now, in your American English-speaking culture, names don't mean a whole lot, but in mine, they do. My name means Yahweh helps. Now, you know me better by my Babylonian name, which is Abednego, which means servant of Nebo God. Now, how I got that name is a story in and of itself for another time. But just goes to show how our faith in the Most High God has constantly been challenged living in this pagan land as exiles. Now, my friends, you know them as Daniel, Shadrach, and Meshach. We talk often and pray often about how we want to remain faithful to God in this foreign land. Life here has not been easy for us, and you're going to see that today. In fact, our faith in God has caused us more trouble than we have ever expected. But it's because our firm belief in Yahweh does help us that I stand before you alive today. Now, as I tell you my story, you're going to notice that I'm frequently going to speak of our faith as opposed to my faith. You Americans are more accustomed to talking about my faith because you live in an individualistic culture. But as a Jew, we live in a culture where it's our faith. It's not because we don't own our faith individually, but because it is so important that we together believe in the Most High God, especially because we live in a strange land. And because we are exiled in a foreign land that doesn't believe in the Most High God, we have to learn to stick together and bond together and rely on one another. And so you're going to see tonight, as I tell you my story, that it's not just about what I believe, but it's about what I believe and what my friends believe. And as a nation, what we believe. Unity and brotherhood became so important to us because we had to stand. We had to stand together. It was during King Nebuchadnezzar's reign that the story begins. We experienced the greatest challenge to our faith that we have ever gone through. The king had made an image of gold, and this image was gigantic. It was 90 feet tall, and it was 9 feet wide. Try to imagine that. Gigantic statue. This was an image that was larger than any of the gods we saw in Babylon, and larger than any of the gods that our kings had set up in the land of Judah. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar placed this image in the land of Dura, which is a suburb of Babylon, and he commanded us to worship it. Now, I'm sure that you remember Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Daniel chapter 2, it's recorded in the scripture. And how Daniel interpreted this dream. The dream was a tall statue that was head of gold and arms and chest of silver, and legs and thighs of bronze, and legs and feet of toes and iron. And Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, he interpreted the dream, he said to him, "You are the head of gold." And I don't think it's any secret to us political officials, me and my friends, that this flattering interpretation went to the king's head, no pun intended there. It was not a coincidence in our view that the king plated this image with gold. And so to us as Jews, this image represented not only the idolatry of the land, but it represented the pride and the self-idolatry of the king himself. So all the king's officials from every political level, I'm going to list them for you here, satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and rulers, all of us were assembled in Babylon and from the surrounding provinces. We were summoned to the dedication ceremony of this tall statue. By the way, this was not just a religious thing, but this was a political thing. This was an exciting day for us. This was a dawning of a new age, as it were, a day where all the nation, all the empire that we live under would be united under one king and under one religion that the king himself instituted. This would be a time of prosperity, be a time of power, it would be a time of prestige. And my friends and I, because we were the political officials that the king himself had appointed, we would be on the top of it all. When we got to this dedication festival, we noticed great festivities. One thing we especially noticed was the music. Babylonians love their music. It intensified the excitement in the air of this moment. This was, as I said, a big moment for us. But the command was issued. The herald said, "Everyone bow down and worship the image when the orchestra begins to play. If anyone refuses, he will immediately be thrown into the furnace of fire." Now, when I heard that, my friends and I, my mind started racing immediately. How could I worship this statue when I believed in the one true God, the Most High God? And to understand that this Most High God is not made in the image of man, if I bowed down before him, this would violate my God's command to never worship any other god before him. And it would degrade my God to the level of created instead of honoring him as the creator. So I made up my mind that I was not going to bow down to this image, no matter the cost. The orchestra began to play, and all our colleagues bowed down. I want you to stand here with me, and I want you to picture what it would have been like for me. As my friends and I looked around at everyone bowing down, we felt very conspicuous. I mean, after all, we were the only ones standing. There was absolutely nowhere to hide. We stood out. But there we stood, feeling the weight of pressure and the embarrassment and the temptation to compromise bearing down upon us heavier and heavier. As we stood there, people began to notice us. And they began to accuse us with their eyes. They began staring at us. We saw them whispering and sneering. And it seemed like the music played for hours and hours. And there we were, just standing. And I glanced at my friends standing beside me. It was obvious that they were feeling the same pressure. But there we stood. And there we stood together. Now, you know what that feels like, don't you? To stand in a crowd when everyone is bowing down. You know what it feels like to stand out in a group, to be the only person who stands for your beliefs, to feel the pressure to conform to what everyone is saying, everyone is talking about, everyone is wearing, or what everyone's doing on Friday night with their friends. You know what that feels like, don't you? But I want to tell you tonight that whatever situations that you're in where you feel that temptation to bow down and to compromise, it may seem very trivial and small in comparison to what we were about to face. But I want to tell you this from my experience, that you must not give in or compromise, no matter what. Most of the time, you're not going to stand alone. I want you to find those friends that you can stand with and that will stand with you and will stand with God no matter what. Hold those friends close to you. Don't ever, ever let them go. Yes, it's going to be hard to stand there by yourselves, but most of the time, you're not going to stand alone. But I'm also going to tell you that even if you do stand alone, you're not really alone at all. Now, as we're standing there, we notice that some people who were bowing down and had noticed us were some of the Chaldeans. Now, these particular Chaldeans, there were three or four of them, and they were pretty jealous of us. We could sense that. They were jealous that we had remarkable success. We were, after all, foreigners, but the king had put us in great position of power. When the orchestra stopped playing and everyone stood up, immediately they came over to us and escorted us to the king himself. And I'm going to tell you that I was really frightened. I was scared, I'll admit it. Who wouldn't be? After all, the king, remember, he had put us in positions of power, and here we are throwing our power back in his face by refusing to bow before his image. And this was his big moment where he was going to unify the entire empire. On top of this, the king was not known for making empty threats. If he said that he's going to throw us in the furnace of fire, we knew what that really meant. We knew that we were in big trouble. When we got before the king, he was already piping mad. And so he asked us if the charges were true that the Chaldeans were bringing. And then before we could answer, he offered us a second chance to bow down before the image as the orchestra was going to play their second piece. When we talked to him, he seemed personally offended, as if we were challenging his own authority. And I guess in a way we were. Not out of disrespect for him as a person, but out of reverence for God. But then he said something that I'm never going to forget. He said, "If you do not worship when the orchestra plays, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Think about that with me for a minute. What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? To us, it became undeniably clear that this king thought that he was better than God. That he thought that he was greater than his gods and that he was even greater than our God. That he thought that there was no one more powerful than him. No one that could veto his decree to worship this God. Now, we knew that he was proud. I mean, we work with the king. We're his servants. But never did we think that he was this proud. This king was challenging God himself. So at this moment, my heart became a flood of emotions. And again, I'm going to admit to you that I was afraid. There was definitely fear. But there was also resolve in me, a determination within me. There was no way that I was going to bow down before this God, this image, even if I could justify it by my inside and say, well, I'm going to bow before the image, but not really bow internally. I understand that my God has expectations. When he says, don't make an image, that means don't even bow down before an image and pretend to worship him. God cares about not only our actions, but our thoughts inside. And I remember as we stood there before the king, exchanging looks with my friends, and I saw the same resolve in their eyes. Without a word spoken to one another, we knew that there was no going back. We had taken our stand, and we would continue to take our stand with God. Now, at the moment, standing here, I didn't realize this, but as I look back upon this moment, I've begun to realize that as my friends and I had talked and prayed together, this had prepared us for this very moment. We knew, as we stood there together, we knew where each other stood. There was no second-guessing each other. There was no second-guessing ourselves. We drew strength from this. It wasn't just my faith. It was our faith. Here's a thought for you to consider. Never think that the times that you spend praying with others who believe in God, or spend time reading Scripture together, or spend time talking about building each other up in God, never think that that's wasted time, because you never know. What you're doing together tonight may just be preparing you for the challenges ahead and allow you to stand together and prepare you to do that. creating bonds with one another and with the Lord to stand up against the strongest attacks on your faith. And so because of this, because we had prepared ourselves for this moment, there was no need for us to excuse ourselves from the king's presence for a moment and huddle up, even if we were allowed to do that, to determine what we were going to do. We had already made our decision long before this moment. And so this is what we said. This is, our words are recorded for you in verses 16 through 18 of Daniel 3. And this is what we said. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. I hear that there are rumors among some scholars and critics that misinterpret what we have said. So before I go on, let me clarify a couple of things. First of all, when you read that and you hear me say that, we meant no disrespect to our king. We understand that God had put him in this position of power and authority. Remember, Daniel had previously said, interpreting the dream, God has made you king. He has given you sovereignty. And so we meant it with the greatest respect to him. We didn't speak with defiance. We didn't speak with rudeness. But what we did do is we spoke our decision plainly. And those two things should not be confused. God expects us to respect those who are in authority over us. And so I hear today that in your day, boldness and clarity are often confused as arrogance and bigotry. And my advice to you today is don't confuse the two. Speak clearly, speak plainly, speak boldly, but speak humbly. But more important than that, don't take our words to mean that we were doubting whether God could deliver us, or that we were even doubting God's existence. We had struggled with doubt before in our lives, but not in this moment. Our words do not convey doubt at all. There was no doubt in our minds that God was able to deliver us from this king. But what we're saying here is that we couldn't be presumptuous and assume that he would, in fact, deliver us, because we don't know his will. We trusted that God is able to do anything he wants to do, but that doesn't mean that we understand everything about God's will or what it means for this particular situation. We really didn't know for sure if God was going to deliver us out of the fire. But one thing we did know is that God was able to do that. And all we are focused on doing is just doing the right thing. Now, when it came right down to it, as I mentioned to you, the king wasn't challenging us, but he was challenging our God. And I thought about some stories in our past. I thought about our ancestor David, who had confronted this uncircumcised Philistine giant, who had defied God and said, "Who is your God?" And David, even though he was a small shepherd boy, he said, I can go up against him because I know God is with us. And what this king had just said is basically the same thing. Who is your God? He's not powerful enough to deliver. What God can deliver you? He asked. And our answer was, our God can. Our God can deliver us. Now, I'm sure, looking back, that those standing there in the courtroom of the king probably laughed at us when we said that. Our God can deliver. And for those that are only no lifeless statues, I'm sure that sounded ridiculous to them. They were mocking us for being so blind and so closed-minded and stubborn. But there it was. We took our stand. Our statement of trust in God had condemned us to death by fire. And your statement of faith today may just cost you your own life. Now, if there is a notable difference between someone being totally enraged and someone being completely infuriated, we saw it there that day. The king's face immediately changed when we told him we weren't going to bow before his God. We saw a distinct change in his face. spit and sweat spewed out as he ordered the furnace to be heated up 7 times hotter than normal. And the king's command was so urgent that he commanded, you know, I expected us to strip us down of all our clothes, but they tied us in all of our clothes, fully clothed, and practically dragged us to the furnace. And I want you to understand now that we are people with emotions just like you. How would you feel if you were being dragged to a furnace of fire? You'd probably be completely terrified, right? That's exactly the way we felt. We were completely terrified of what was going to happen. All I could think to do was to pray and to plead with my brothers to pray. Sometimes that's all you can do in a moment like that, when you see death just staring at you in the face. The flames were so hot that as they shoved us into the fire, the soldiers who dragged us there, they were killed themselves immediately. Try to imagine with me the terror and the feel of being burned alive. That's what we were about to face. But what happened next surprised us just as much as everybody else. We were thrown down on the ground, and the flames licked around us. They burned the ropes that dropped off of us, but we did not feel one of the flames at all. Not a single bit of heat. In the fire, there appeared with us a man. His face was different. It was amazing that he looked different, and we didn't know what was happening, so our bonds were loose. We stood up. We started walking around with him. We thought he was an angel. And suddenly we heard voices on the other side of the entrance shouting at us to come out, come out. And we did. And before us stood the king himself, utterly astonished. His look of enrage and fury had changed to just complete surprise. As we looked down at ourselves and at one another, we saw that not one inch of our coats, our pants, our hats, not even our hair was singed. We did not even smell like smoke. I don't know how that happened, but it did. It all happened so fast that it wasn't until we came out of the fire that we really began to put two and two together. That our God had delivered us. That our God had rescued us. He had answered our prayers. Indeed, He had quenched the power of fire. And so we praised God openly right then in front of the king and right there. And King Nebuchadnezzar himself began blessing God, our God, and he ordered a decree to be written that one should not speak offensively about our God upon pain of death. And so this is our story. This is my story of how God delivered us and was vindicated as the most powerful king. And though the king still worships his other gods, he recognizes that our God is a legitimate God to worship. But I want you to read with me verse 29, the king's own decree. Verse 29, therefore I make a decree that any nation, any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to an ash heap. Or a rubbish heap. Inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. The question that the king asked us as he challenged us is, who is able, what God is able to deliver you out of my hand? And here he is admitting in his public decree that there is no other God who can deliver like the Most High. There's his humility there. The king indeed answered his own question. Friends, there are three lessons that I'd like to share with you tonight from our experience. The first lesson is about the foolishness of human arrogance. The second lesson is about the need that we have for unconditional faith. And the third lesson is about God's power to deliver you. The first lesson about pride. As I look back upon this personal encounter with the king, the most powerful man on the face of the earth, I understand more of what Isaiah said when he wrote, before our time, Isaiah chapter 14 in verses 13 and 14. And there in that passage, he is speaking specifically about the king of Babylon, perhaps this very king that we stood before. Isaiah said, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will make myself like the Most High. The real idol that we saw that day wasn't the statue that was 90 feet tall, but it was the king that we stood before. It was the king himself. That's why he was so angry when we told him, we're not going to bow before your statue, because it challenged his authority. It challenged and questioned his pride. As I thought about this, it occurred to me just how foolish it is for any king, for any person, whether it be me or whether it be you, to think of ourselves as greater than the Most High. That was the king's problem. He thought of himself as greater than our God. But you know, as foolish as that is, we do that all the time. Pride doesn't just exist in tyrants like Nebuchadnezzar. It's in every single one of us. For example, when we think we can define good and evil, we think we can say what is right and what is wrong, when God, the Most High, has already said that. He's already decided it. When we think we're secure because we live in a nation with a strong military, or when we are offended and we attack people who question our beliefs, when we boast of our own accomplishments without any regard to the great giver of life. When we do this, when we exalt ourselves above God, I also think about what Isaiah said in that same passage. He said to the king of Babylon, "Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, 'Is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home?'" What Isaiah said of the king of Babylon is, though you exalt yourself and lift yourself up, you're going to be brought low. And people are going to be so surprised at that. Is this the king who exalted himself? Isaiah was telling him and us that if we lift ourselves up, God will bring us down. Now, on the second point about unconditional faith, I thought about how to say this, but I don't know how to put this any softer way without losing the point. So here it goes. In your modern American style Christianity, your faith is so puny and flimsy. Your most popular speakers preach a pathetic message of faith based upon convenience. People ask, if I serve God, what is he going to give me in return? What is he going to do for me? How is he going to make my life more prosperous and more comfortable? You Americans approach God with the attitude of a consumer. I'm going to pay God X amount of reverence or worship or service. Then what is he going to give to me in ease, in money, in acceptance, in popularity? And I'm here today to tell you that that is not the way we treat the Most High God as Jews. We have more reverence for God than that. We don't give God his due in order to get what is due us. We give God his due because he is God. Now, I know that my faith and my friend's faith is not perfect. But I do know that that kind of faith, based upon convenience and ease, is really no faith at all. That kind of a brittle faith cannot stand the kind of test that we faced. And I hear that in your own country, in your own churches, in your own families, your faith is starting to break down. Because you make it dependent upon what God is going to give you in ease and acceptance among others. Especially under the pressure of pluralism and don't judge anyone kind of thinking. And you try to compromise with that. I will tell you that if we had that faith there standing before the king, if we had that kind of faith, life would have been a lot more easy for us, sure, but we would have compromised the thing that is most precious and dear to us, and that is our faith in a God who delivers us. If there's one thing that my friends and I had to realize when our faith was literally under fire, is that God never promises us to cushion us. He never promises to cushion us from life's hardships and trials. In fact, he assures you of the exact opposite. He tells you that you will suffer if you believe in him. God tells you, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that comes among you. which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. In another place, he says, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed through various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. God delivered us through the fire. But he didn't do that to prove to you that he's going to deliver you from every suffering or spare you of every suffering. But to prove, he did this to prove his power to an arrogant king. Remember, we still were thrown into fire. We had to face the fear of that. In fact, after us, Daniel says, prophesies that some will come who will not be spared the fire. They will indeed be burned at the hands of kings. But here's my question for you tonight. Will you serve a God that allows you to suffer in order to test the strength of your faith in him? He tests you just to ask you how much you trust in him. You know, even if we had died in the fire, we would have still been victors because we believed that God always delivers those who trust him. But that leads me to my third point. When you read Daniel chapter 3, don't think of me, or Meshach, or Shadrach, or even Daniel, who, by the way, was away on business. Don't think of us as the heroes of the story, because we're not. We were just the humble servants of the Most High God, trying to do what's right. We're not the heroes. God is the hero, because he's the one who delivered. Even Nebuchadnezzar, at the end of the day, understood that God was the hero. He himself said in verse 28, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielding up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God." Even this pagan king, who did not really worship this God even after this, he understood that God's the hero. This is the most important lesson, that God will deliver you. Whatever you face, God will deliver you. If he doesn't promise that he's going to spare us from suffering in this life, as I've already mentioned, then what kind of deliverance are we to look for? Not necessarily always for an earthly deliverance, that God's going to pluck you out of the fire, as it were. But God tells us to look for an eternal deliverance beyond the fiery furnace. Perhaps even a resurrection from the dead. In fact, if you think about it, we were sentenced to death. And we were thrown into the fire and expected and basically good as dead at that point. But God delivered us out of that. We were sentenced to death by the most powerful king on earth, but God overruled this to bring us back to life. And I can't be too sure, but I do wonder if there's some deeper significance to that than what I can see now. But next time you stand alone in a crowd that's bowing down before the gods of this world, and you stand alone and you suffer the wrath of the people who will mock and deride you, don't walk away from your faith. Don't compromise. Stand with God. Stand with those who believe. Not only does God see you there in the fire, but he is there with you in the fire. Tonight, will you serve a God who allows you to suffer, allows you to be tempted? But those are trials that bring us through the fire. Will you stand now, while you're among friends now, and confess your faith in him as we stand and as we sing?